Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. A legislative committee agrees that more funding is needed for court and treatment services. The committee met yesterday as they continued their study of imprisonment alternatives. They couldn't agree, however, on whether ingesting controlled substances should be a felony in South Dakota. We'll talk about this and much more with today's Dakota Political Junkies. John Hunter is with us on the phone. He's the publisher of the Madison Daily Leader. John, a pleasure to have you back.
It's a pleasure to be here, Lori.
And Noel Hamill is joining us from the Black Hills Surgical Hospital Studio in SDPB's Rapid City Studio. He's a columnist with the Rapid City Journal and a former South Dakota State Legislature. Noel, welcome back as well.
Thank you.
And member of the South Dakota Newspaper Hall of Fame. I always have to add that. Let's start with talking about ingestion as a felony, because as this legislative committee meets, so their next meeting is November 1st, you could really see in some of the dialogue some of the deep challenges with this and the deep division. Noel, start us out with an overview, if you would, please, and we'll dig into the issues.
Well, first of all, I wanted to congratulate the lawmakers who pushed for this as a summer study. Remember, this had two parts. I think one committee was studying industrial hemp, and the other one was studying the state's drug laws, and I thought they were both excellent and timely topics. On the drug laws, which was the focus of the Tuesday meeting in Pierre, it became clearer than ever, based on the accounts that I read, that there are two sides of this question, maybe more than two. Basically, though, would reducing the state's ingestion drug penalty from a felony to a misdemeanor, would that help or hurt prison overcrowding, which is one of the concerns? Would it reduce costs? Would it help addicts? Would it help or hinder law enforcement? Would it make society safer, less safe? You know, the committee was struggling with all those questions. I think there is sort of a consensus that if you reduced it, the penalty for ingestion of illegal drugs, if you reduced it from a felony to a misdemeanor, costs would go down. And drug users could be helped more if that savings was used for more diversion programs. Minnehaha State's attorney was quoted in one of the stories I read that he said watering down drug laws wouldn't reduce the drug epidemic. But this week, I talked to former Corrections Secretary Dennis Kamek at some length. He was secretary of the under the Dugard administration, and he definitely believes that reducing most ingestion offenses to misdemeanors and placing much more emphasis on diversion programs is the way to go. So it's a divisive issue. Another leading voice in this is Senator Craig Kennedy of Yankton, and he continues to point out that South Dakota is the only state that has a felony penalty for ingestion of a controlled substance. I think he said it was $5 million a year to house these inmates convicted of that crime. And his position, of course, is that it could be used for more effective programs. What we didn't see, or maybe at least I didn't see, coming out of Tuesday's meeting, which was the third of the summer, was any basis for upcoming legislation during the January session. I mean, it looks, from where I sit, it looks to me like there's still a lot of work to be done before finding the common ground required for legislation to be drafted.
Which, of course, is the big challenge overall. John Hunter, what are you sort of seeing coming out of these meetings, and any hopes for some potential action?
Well, I think Noel summarized it nicely on what that what they're trying to do in the summer study.
Yeah.
I think in most cases there is unanimous opinion on what we want to end up happening, and that is you want lower imprisonment if possible, and you want people, these diversion programs, to be effective and not people get involved in the first place or rehabilitated. The challenge is not so much in the goal setting as in the what actually works. As we've discovered when we a few years ago when they had a criminal justice reform and essentially keeping some of those folks out of the state penitentiary, is that and we said, well, then we'll, you know, we'll rehabilitate them and so forth. First of all, a very substantial shortage of counselors and others who can help with that, with taking addicts and removing that burden from them. But also then the recidivism rate, where people are committing new crimes. And again, that all starts at the county level and filling up county jails beyond their capacity. And of course, construction of new jails in different parts of the states, Brown County most notable, Lake County as well, and has talked about it. But so it hasn't, you know, I think there's kind of unanimous opinion that it isn't working right now. But can we get, what kind of action can we get? We know there has been some success in the drug courts and that portion, but we just don't know how effective we can get that. And until you have counselors and these programs that can remove this problem, if someone has this either felony or misdemeanor problem, that they can return to society and get back in action, then I don't think we have a solution yet.
I want to talk about what's helpful to finding that solution, because you mentioned Noel Craig Kennedy, state senator from Yankton, and then Representative Stephen Haugard is the Sioux Falls Republican chairing the committee. And, you know, Kennedy is saying, you know, we don't need to be the only state who's doing this. And Steve Haugard points out that he believes the issue, and I'm quoting him from an Argus Leader article right now, is the issue is largely people who have not been properly parented over the years, and parents who haven't raised children who are able to resist or choosing to resist the temptation. There's a lot happening there with just sort of how people sort of view addiction in general, and I'm wondering if the idea that this is a parenting problem is helpful to moving toward a solution. Noel, what do you think?
Well, I think that there's basis for Haugard's statement. During my conversation with Dennis Kamek, who I said was the longtime correction secretary, he said one of the things that we talked about was how drug abuse is generational. I think he said something like 80%. I hope I'm right about that, but I think he said something like 80% of young people that are convicted of ingestion, their parents or their guardians, or there was a connection in the family where there was also a drug problem. Apparently, it's that's a factor that has to be examined. I'm glad you brought the point up, Lori, because so much of the discussion seems to focus on diversion programs. How do we handle, should we change the penalty for addictive behavior? It's an epidemic. And it doesn't seem like a lot of time is spent, I mean, those are symptoms of a deeper cause. I mean, why do people use drugs in the first place? And while on one level we think we know the answer to that, and it's a complex answer. It could be young people experimenting. It could be pain relief. It could be a lot of, and you know, you try something once and then you're addicted. But I think the parenting piece, if you look at it, it's much broader than just parenting. It relates also to the culture in which we live. And it would be great, I think, if the committee would focus also on the root causes of the drug epidemic, not just ways to deal with it.
And John Hunter, as we say that, I think of a parent like Angela Kenneke with Kello, who has been on this program, has been very vocal about the death of her daughter through a fentanyl overdose. And I think some of those parents who have fought the battle of addiction in their own homes would bristle at the idea that somehow it was their parenting that, you know, caused this disease to take root in their homes with tragic consequences. John Hunter, your thoughts on the parenting connection?
Yeah, that's I understand what you're saying, and I tend to agree with it that it's that there are many parents who are doing their best, and for whatever reasons that someone in their family gets involved in this kind of thing, and could be, you know, something that goes on with a peer or at school, or as Noel indicated, society, could be a neighboring state where these things might be legal. So there's all sorts of things that, the societal problem is big. It's not caused by any one person. There may be even possibility of genetic predisposition to some of those things. There may be, again, pain things, and we've certainly seen that in the opioid epidemic going on. I do think there are some things that were as family challenges, if there are family situations that might lend itself to people trusting others outside the family. If you don't have maybe trust in your parents or something, you trust the neighbor or something.
What I'm wondering really, and Noel, maybe you can chip in too, is this idea that we know now that addiction is a disease in a way that we didn't know, even 10 years ago. We understand addiction more clearly than we did before. And part of, what I'm hearing on this show and other places, when people come in and want to talk about it, the first thing they say is, God, we got to get past this stigma. And nobody will talk about it if we think, it's mom's fault. It's a disease, and it needs to be treated. And what you're hearing someone like Pennington County Sheriff Kevin Tome say, it doesn't need to be treated in jail.
Well, I think if I get back really to people who can help, whatever that the disease or the addiction, we're suffering a severe shortage of counselors and those who can help, both at the Human Services Center in Yankton and statewide through drug courts. And I think in all parts of the state, there simply aren't enough of those folks who can help. Even the hospital systems with their resources are having trouble getting counselors or whatever they're called. I mean, there's a variety of different titles that go with those things. But
sure.
We can say we want to divert these things, but if we don't have the people to help on that, we can't get it done.
Right. If you have no place to do the diversion. It's interesting how different people come at it from. And Noel, do you want to, Senator Craig Kennedy mentioned it during some of the testimony, and SDPB's Lee Strubinger did a report about really how this is applied. The ingestion law impacts Native Americans more than any other demographic in the state, where you've got 16% of non-Native females, for example, are in prison with their primary crime is ingestion, but it's 23% of female Native Americans. So 16% non-Natives, that's a huge difference in how this felony is being applied.
And the statistics, I think, are true. Keep in mind that the statistics, cultural indicators for a lot of things are higher on the reservations, and that's really an unfortunate picture that we can draw from reservation life. I believe the statistics are more negative in other facets of life there as well. What I think is that diversion programs really are a big part of the answer, not prison. I go along with that. I think that when you send a young person to prison, mix them in a felon population for ingestion of drugs, he's going to probably not be helped by that environment, whereas if he were involved in a diversion program, his chances would be much better of becoming a person in society who can make a contribution. I do have a little bit of a hang-up still on simply saying, well, drug addiction is a disease, because for a lot of people, and I know that it has been so defined, but I think there's still a distinction that can be made between something that you choose to do, choose to try, you become addicted, as compared to a disease that you contract through no fault of your own, whether it's leukemia or cancer or liver disease. Let's let's not forget that the addictions in our society do have some personal responsibility connected to them. And I think that makes a big difference in how we look at the problem and the treatment of it.
Let's pivot. We have a couple more topics to get to today. I want to make sure that we mention First Gentleman Brian Noem and this a new initiative he has. John Hunter, you wrote about it in your opinion column for the Madison Daily Leader. Tell us a little bit about First Gentleman Noem and what he is, what we're seeing that he is interested in, and sort of throwing that title behind.
Right, and that's been for decades that the title of first spouse, whether it's a man or a woman, has been used to further, I think, great things for the state. Usually, something personally important to the first lady in the past, or now the first gentleman, Governor Noem's husband Brian, and I think it's great because the first spouse takes passion for something they already believe in, and then put the weight of the title behind it and so on. So Brian's is really to, and this is the first that he's come out with something on his own, is to have a spotlight, I think, on small town South Dakota and try to tell stories of what great things are going on in small towns, promote small towns and their kinds of activities and their contributions to the state. All good. We don't know much, at least out of the initial announcement, how that's going to take place. He said he wants to visit these places. He wants to listen. He wants to forward those messages on. We don't know how he's going to do that. And really, if he's going to, if it's a success that can be measured, we say, you know, more activity in small towns or more knowledge about it. So it's still a little unclear how it's going to be implemented. I think it's a great topic, and but I do want to. I would love to see results too. I don't want to just say that, or have this program be, let's try this and then not put some real effort and weight behind it.
Right, Noel Hamill, your thoughts on the initiative, and you know, how do you measure the results of something like that?
Well, I love the idea of focusing on small towns. It's been a special interest of mine for decades. When I was with the South Dakota Foundation, I crisscrossed the state visiting small towns. And not just small towns, but some larger towns, too, trying to help them set up their own foundations and figuring out ways they could do projects without spending tax dollars. I like the idea. I hope that it isn't. The news story said that he wants to celebrate the hidden gems of South Dakota and tell the story of small towns or the heartbeat of the state, which is great. I agree. But that isn't the challenge that small towns face. They, from an economic standpoint, they've been in decline. Most of them have been in decline for years. We all know that. And everybody knows why. It's a population thing. Fewer but larger farms, better highways to the large box stores. It's a numbers game. And my hope is that he uses this to tie in with his wife's larger stated objective, which is to broaden the economic base in South Dakota, create better jobs. And I hope that somehow the first gentleman comes up with some ways after visiting small towns that can be leveraged as part of the overall economic growth. Because, you know, small towns are great, but They need new ideas. They need to be energized, and economic growth really is the only answer to that.
And that's something that you think that how would that tie in, Noel? Other than a campaign sort of thing, but how does he tie that into the work that Governor Noem is doing?
Well, here's
in Pierre. Yeah.
I'm
right. Yeah,
well,
it's early.
A newspaper man.
Yeah, we're speculating big here, but
one of the things he talked about was ag aftermarket. I mean, and Mark Mickelson said that, too, before he dropped out. You know, we're an ag state. So how do we not just vertically integrate, but horizontally integrate agriculture? What sorts of enterprises can we use to capitalize on our farming and ranching productivity? And what role would small towns play in that? As one example, I mean, there are some examples already in existence. When I used to travel the state, I would see small businesses that make stock trailers, or I'd see small businesses that I think would make squeeze chutes for cattle operations. Feeding bunks for ranchers that feed cattle. What sort of extensions can be put on agriculture in this state that would be a natural for smaller communities and for the people that live there and for the children that grow up there so that they could stay there? That's kind of what I'm getting at. That's maybe a pretty primitive example, but that's sort of what I'm thinking about.
All right. It's an interesting story to follow. It's interesting to see, because we don't see him very much, do we, John Hunter, yet. This is, you know, sort of one of the first gentleman initiatives that we've seen out of Brian Noe.
Right. And different first spouses have had more or less time available to them. Brian is a working farmer rancher and has parenting responsibilities and so on. I mean, like most people, but... So yes, it isn't a full-time position for him. So yeah, I think I'm with Noel all the way on. We'd love to see some results out of this, that somehow small towns benefit from this, these visits or this increased. And it's a complicated issue to try to boost economic development. There's housing issues. There's education issues. There's all sorts of population moving trends and all sorts. So. I'm also optimistic, but we need to see what's going to happen next.
Right, and you could compare that to First Lady Linda Dugard's, you know, sort of twin efforts. She had child literacy and did a lot of reading and you know, is that how measurable was that to say did that make a difference in school readiness? But versus the infant mortality, where there were efforts that maybe lent themselves to a little more measuring. So. It'll be interesting to follow that going forward. Before we let you go, let's very quickly say the South Dakota Democratic Party still in debt. How hard is it going to be to turn that ship around, Noel?
Well, I think they really blew it when they didn't hire Billy Sutton to head up the party. You know, when he lost that close election, and I said this in 2010 when Stephanie Herseth lost her bid to Christie. You know, they need somebody at the top to rebuild the party, somebody that's charismatic, like Billy Sutton or Stephanie Herseth, somebody who is moderate, like Sutton or Herseth. They need somebody at the top. You wouldn't remember, Lori, because you're not old enough, but in the 50s, George McGovern was maybe the Democratic Party's first executive director, and he went from town to town, and he really did re-energize and build up the Democratic Party. And that's sort of grassroots effort by a person has not occurred since then that I'm aware of. And you know what? They're in bad shape. I mean, it's not just the financial stories you're reading about. Look at the registration numbers. Look at the election numbers. They need some strong leadership at the top, and I think that... Now, I know that Billy Sutton started his... What was it called? A Leadership
Sutton
Institute?
Sutton Leadership Institute, yeah.
And I don't know how that ties in. I did see where the first class graduated this summer, but... I just think the party missed an opportunity there. They should have given him a 5-year no-cut contract.
Hmm. John Hunter, thoughts on is it about a person, that kind of, in Paula Hawks is running the show. She's brand new. If she's listening, she's probably saying, well, what do you think I'm doing here? Of course I'm
not
going.
Being critical of Paula Hawks. I'm not. I just was... trying to focus on high-profile Democrats.
It's going to take that kind of effort. It's going to take that kind of, door-to-door, George McGovern-type work. John Hunter, is that what it takes?
Well, yeah, I think there's certainly charisma, but it's an evangelism thing.
There you go.
You need to go sell that, and that's hard, and it often requires money, and effort, and time, and people, and all sorts of things. It's clearly you're starting from a modest base and trying to build that, I think the financial thing is a challenge, and I doubt if anyone expected it to turn around quickly. I mean,
right. The
Argus Leader story said, "Well, we're in the second month of this. Well, it was not going to get fixed in 1 month, so it'll take time to do that. But they'll have to raise some money and so forth. And yes, getting it on sound financial grounds, you do need those fundamentals of bookkeeping and auditing and disclosure and all that sort of stuff. Those are fundamentals, but I think it needs an evangelist, as Noel was describing.
Right, and a base to where people feel like they can write that big check and something good will happen with it. I mean,
right.
Any organization that goes through getting bruised like they have is going to have to prove to donors that the money is well spent.
Well, and I think attracting, in order to attract that, it really has to have a vision. And the mm-hmm. vision of, I don't want to criticize the vision that they have, but I do know that each political party needs something beyond being the anti-other party. In other words, you have to have the vision of your own for something great in order to raise that money, rather than just say we're against all the things that the other people are against.
Oh. John Hunter and Noel Hamill, a rich discussion as always on this week's Dakota Political Junkies. Noel, thank you so much for being here with us.
Thank you, Lori.
And Noel joined us from the SDPB's Rapid City Studios. John Hunter, thanks for being here as well. Always a pleasure.
Thanks, Lori. Look forward to the next one.